Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Today we are joined by David Boucher, who is the CEO of Boucher & Co., a company that specializes in luxury high-end furniture and gifts. These gifts are not just any old kind of luxury high-end gift or piece of furniture. These are so exquisite, so unique that they've been commissioned by kings, queens, movie stars, captains of industry. And indeed, as far as I'm aware, David is the only person who's been commissioned by Rolls-Royce to create a custom interior for what is now known as the Boucher Rolls-Royce Ghost. David, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jesse. Good to hear your voice, mate.
Thanks, mate. It's good to hear yours too. We're going to obviously delve a lot into the, you know, the business that you operate in and all that's come from it. And it's a fascinating story. But I'm guessing that some of the audience today won't be as familiar with Boucher & Co. and your story. And I know that, you know, you grew up in Queensland, started off in Toowoomba and grew up on farms and that. And it's a fascinating journey just to get an understanding of how a country kid kind of turned their hand to this business that you're in and have created a reputation that's global and known for such exquisite artistry. Can you just walk us through a bit about that, mate?
Sure. So I grew up on a little farm in Stanthorpe in Queensland on the southern end of Queensland and just not long after the war. And it was a very poor area. So I grew up learning very quickly that you could do quite a lot with not much and that if something broke, you could just fix it. And if you didn't have one of them, you just made it. And if you had a problem, you worked out the solution for it and then you engineered the solution and you got it done. So, you know, growing up with that sort of background makes you open to all sorts of interesting things. And the other thing that you need to hear about is that during the day I was working on the farm as a kid, but at night time, Mum and Dad ran an amateur theatre company to entertain the locals. There was no TV. And so at night time, I was behind the scenes at the theatre watching them produce the magic that created the plays and whatever they were doing. And so I got a real understanding of theatre and of how much people enjoyed theatre. So, you know, as years moved on, actually at the age of 15, I lost my dad. He was killed in a level crossing accident. And not very long after that, I had a bit of a barney with my brothers and I ran away from home. So I never finished school. Mm-hmm. And I went to Townsville and worked on road gangs and ended up in Brisbane. And a few years later, I was riding very big motorbikes with a knife in my boot and long hair and one of those leather jackets that you know, those you don't want, not the person you want to bring home to meet your mother.
Yeah. You don't want your daughter to meet someone like you when you're a teenager.
So when I met Margaret, my darling wife,
yeah,
that's what she met.
Wow.
And no wonder she didn't want to take me home and meet her mother. But she'll tell you that she recognises potential. So, and only a couple of years after we were married, at the age of 21, I just got sick of working on road gangs and machinery. And I said to her one day, there's got to be more to life than digging holes in the ground and filling them back in.
Yep.
And she said to me, you've always been handy with your hands. Why don't you try making some furniture? And that's how it started.
And so did you start off, I mean, clearly, you know, that inspiration from theatre and seeing how the production unraveled, I can see how that's, you know, come across in your pieces now because you're so well known for your mechanical furniture with the secret compartments. But I'm guessing that was not where you started off, going from a road gang to that.
No.
What was the start point?
So the very first furniture I made, I actually rescued some furniture, some timber from a work site that we were on. And that's a euphemism for stealing it, I suppose. But they were going to burn it. They were going to burn the timber. I mean, I felt I was rescuing it.
Yeah.
And I took it home and made us some bar stools. And then I went around and knocked on doors for the next 6 weeks until I sold them. And at the end of that 6 weeks, when I sold them, I came home that night and I said to Margaret, well, that's it. Well, I can do this. We're in business.
Wow.
And I quit my job. Now, I would not recommend this because I never did a trade. And that's a really hard way to learn how to do anything, yeah, is to try and experiment your way to success. And but the other side of that is that because I didn't learn a trade, I wasn't taken down one particular area, and that's all I ever knew how to do. I was open to anything. And when people would come along and say, can you do this? I'd just say yes and figure out how to do it afterwards. So it soon developed into a thing, and we've actually had a couple of fairly substantial business failures, and the first one of those happened in 1982.
Yep.
And the net result of that, a company went down and took us with it. Mm-hmm. And I was very young, very inexperienced, had really no idea, yep, of anything. And the net result of that was that we ended up with Margaret and myself, two kids at the time. I think we had $50 to our name and we had a push bike. That was it. And so some friends said to us, come out to us in Dalby in Western Queensland and we'll look after you out there. So we went out there and we ended up starting another business out there. And that business was doing restoration work.
Yeah.
And restoration work teaches you how furniture is built, because you've got to pull furniture that was made by a master, you've got to pull that furniture apart. So you understand at the end of the day how he did it. And
okay,
you learn as you go. And, you know, the first bit of carving I ever did was a lady came in with a chair and she said, I've got this chair, it's got three legs. Can you do the fourth leg?
Wow.
And I looked at it and I went, okay. So I rang up the guy who sold the woodworking tools down in Brisbane. Yeah. And I said to him, you've got carving chisels? And he said, yes. And I said, can you send me up a couple? And he said, well, which ones do you want? And I said, I don't know, just the normal ones. He said, there's 600 chisels in the range. You know, I didn't realize wood carving was such a special thing. I just thought, oh, wood carving, anyone can do that.
Yeah.
And ended up, he sent me a selection of about 30 chisels.
Yeah.
And I just worked my way through it and figured it out as I went. And as we grew the business, I started employing people because we couldn't keep up with the workload.
Yep.
And as we started making pieces for people, that's when I started to realize that I had a bit of a design talent and I could design things that they liked.
Wow.
And it just grew from there.
Yeah. So what I really love about that, there's a couple of really interesting pieces that have come out of that, David, though I think you've stood you in good stead in my view anyway, but that relentless curiosity to see how things are done and to see if you can do it better and learn, as you say, from the masters. But the other thing that's really interesting is the fact that you didn't have the apprenticeship. As you say, perhaps you wouldn't necessarily recommend that, but you weren't funnel down a particular path, so you didn't go in with preconceived ideas or assumptions, and as you say, you went in with an open mind, and you were literally a clean slate, a blank canvas from which to draw upon. So that's obviously how it was said.
I've met a few people who are professionals and they've become an accountant or they've become a lawyer or something, and I've met them in later years and we've talked about what they're doing and are they happy.
Yeah.
And they've all, these few people have said to me, you know, I went this direction and that's all I know how to do, but I'm not happy doing it. And I just wish that I hadn't gone that direction. I wish I'd tried something else. And I've also met other people who are in our industry, and I've said to them, well, you know, you do a really good job of that particular thing. Why don't you have a go at doing this? And they say, oh, no, that's the only thing I know how to do. It's what I've been trained to do. And so they leave themselves really closed off to other opportunities. Whereas if you have an open mind to what else you might be able to do, it really opens up the world to you and lets you do amazing things. The other thing I think that's really important is not to be fazed by important people, not to be thrown out. I've made friends with some of the most amazing people around the world, with royalty, with movie stars, with, you know, very, very expensive people. I've had them come and sit down in our kitchen and help me cook dinner, and we've sat down and had a meal together.
Yep.
And you come to understand that they're just people like you, and they've got fears and they've got concerns, and that if you can relate to them and just relax, it opens up all sorts of doors, and a lot of people just aren't game. Get out there and talk to these people. Like, you know, Margaret's often said to me, "You'll go where lions fear to tread," but I've never been particularly worried about picking up the phone and talking to somebody in a very high position, because I know that they're just another person, just like me. They put their pants on in the morning, they have a cup of tea. They're just, you know, they've got fears and worries. They're trying to do things. If I can give them a solution to something that they're trying to sort out, yes, of course they'll talk to me.
And isn't that just the essence of business, though, don't you think, David? Because you're in the furniture business and I operate a dental practice, and it's exactly the same in the sense that, you know, you'll have a conversation with people, as you quite rightly point out, you know, everyone pulls their pants on the same way in the morning and has a cup of tea and the like. And ultimately, we're trying to understand people's, you know, concerns, frustrations, ambitions, and give them something that's going to make their life, you know, more enjoyable, more pleasant, more, you know, more whatever, and meet that need for them. Is that kind of how you see it as well?
Yeah, absolutely. and I think it's a really interesting thing to be able to sit down and get to the root of things very quickly. So that's why we have people around to our place. One of the first things we do with a new client is we have them around for dinner.
Yeah.
Because when you sit down and break bread with someone, when you cook a meal for someone, it breaks down barriers very quickly and opens doors to things. You find out stuff about them. You get right down to what they really love and what they hate and what they enjoy doing. And it, for me, it leads me in the direction of where I need to go to create something very special for them. And invariably, they'll give me all sorts of hints that will help me create something that's so personal and so them that they can really invest in it in time and effort and passion, and they can become involved and become part of the whole process and really enjoy the process of seeing something go from an idea on a piece of paper that happened while we were sitting around having a glass of wine and a meal that they helped cook into drawings and then into prototypes and through the whole process of building this extraordinary thing that they are going to be able to tell their grandchildren stories about.
And that's a really interesting thing as well, David, to understand a little bit about, just to, you know, talk about the product itself for a moment. You know, when we hear about Boucher & Co., we automatically think about the exquisite furniture that you create and the hidden compartments and the mechanical furniture and all those things, which of course you do extremely well and better than probably anyone on the planet. But I'm wondering, you know, part of your product really is what goes around the piece of furniture, from what I'm listening to. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah. It's an experience that you enjoy. So we create amazing experiences for people. It's just that we happen to use artwork furniture to do that. But the whole experience of doing business with a small, intimate group of people who will work to create something that's got a great story, that's really fascinating and interesting, people love that. And they love that, but at the end of the day, they're as much an expert on this piece as what I am, because I've kept them in the loop all the way through and told them the stories of what's happened, and they've grown along with it and they've absorbed those stories. And now when they have guests come around, they become the hero of the night because they tell these great stories and everybody has a great time and they think it's fascinating. And I've given that gift to them.
Yes.
So it's not just a piece. Now they have a story that goes with the piece and they know things about it that other people don't know, and they can share that with their friends, and they can create a really great experience for them. So the experience that they've had, they pass on.
I think that's so wonderful. And I've just got this vision of, you know, children sitting on their parents' knee at night hearing the stories about this piece of furniture. And I can imagine in generations to come, those stories are going to be handed down from generation to generation to generation. And the Boucher & Co. Label and name is going to be going for years and generations, David. So just by virtue of those stories, which I think is just terrific. And anyone listening to this as well, you know, clearly the audience is, you know, will be mainly dentists, but one of the things that, you know, if you think back to some of the conversations that we've had on previous episodes, and David will know Andrew Griffiths, who we've spoken about spoken with previously, and one of the things we speak about is it's about the story that goes around what you do. And so what I really love about what you're doing, David, is yes, you've created this exquisite piece of artwork that happens to be furniture, but the story that goes with it is just as priceless as the individual piece of furniture, which is just terrific.
Yeah, I'm doing a series at the moment called the Postcard Series, and it's just I've got a group, a tribe that follow me that are clients.
Yep.
And so I send out to them I suppose you would call it a newsletter, but it's not. It's a postcard from. And the one I sent out yesterday was a postcard from Paris. And it tells the story of a piece of furniture. It's a round, tall cabinet, and you open it up and there's a bar inside it.
Oh, beautiful.
But the timber that's in it comes from a tree that was lost during a storm in December of 1999.
Yes.
And there was a huge set of storms that went throughout Europe, and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of trees were lost. But this particular tree was standing in the Palace of Versailles Gardens.
Oh, wow.
And as it, you know, went through the problems of the storm, it obviously blew over and was lost. And the timber was then recovered. And I got a phone call from a fellow over there a few years later, and he said, "You're never going to believe what I've got my hands on."
Yeah.
He said, I've got some timber that came out of the Palace of Versailles Garden, and it actually predates the palace.
Oh, wow.
And so he said, you know, I'm thinking that this is something that, you know, Louis the 14th and Marie Antoinette and probably even Napoleon would have walked past this tree. I mean, imagine the stories this tree could tell.
Yeah.
So we got a hold of this timber, and it was extraordinary. It's ash burl. It's a creamy brown timber with very busy and lots of amazing grain in it, and very rich. And we used it to create this extraordinary cabinet. And so I tell the story of this timber and its history and all that in this postcard from, I call it the postcard from Versailles.
Oh, wow.
And it talks about the piece and the fact that this timber of Louis the 14th and Marie Antoinette, this piece of timber is going to live on for generations to come.
Mm.
And that story has had the most extraordinary response. I'm getting emails from all around the world today from all these people that have read it and have come back and said, "Wow, what an amazing story, and what an incredible piece, and isn't that incredible?" Now, here's the thing. That piece is not brand new. It's a few years old, and I've had it on display in our gallery over that period of time. And some of the people who have written back to me and said, "That's the most amazing story, and I can't wait to come in and see it," actually have seen the piece of furniture, but they've never heard the story.
See, that's so powerful, isn't it? Wow, that is such a great lesson to tell the story.
Yeah. So, and my wife's fault again, because she said to me, "You know, well, listen to you, when you're talking to all these people, you tell all these great stories, but only the one person hears the story, the person that's standing in front of you.
Yep.
You've got to write those stories down." And it's hard work. We were talking about this earlier, but I've nearly finished writing my book. And 58,000 words. I tell you, that was hard work, dragging those stories out of myself and writing them down.
But I feel your pain, mate. I feel your pain.
But it was fantastic to do it. And the people who've read the draft of it are blown away by it, because there's so many backstories of things. Like the Rolls-Royce story is amazing, you know, where in 2013, basically Rolls-Royce knocked on the door and said, "Can you do what you do inside our cars?" But there's a backstory to that story.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
Going back to 1994,
yep.
We had moved our business from Dalby into Toowoomba in 1989,
mm-hmm.
and we built this beautiful new workshop where the business is these days. And I was looking at opportunities and trying to think of different things to do, and I thought, you know, I should get onto Rolls-Royce and see if they would do a tour and bring some of their clients up here, and because their clients have got to be our clients, and if we can get them up to Toowoomba and show them around. So I rang the Rolls-Royce dealership. There was one in Brisbane at that time.
Yes.
And there's a gentleman by the name of Alan Piper. And it took me about a week to get through to him, because every time I rang, I started off wasn't very experienced at this at the time, and I just rang up and got the girl or whoever the girl was, and and I said to her, you know, look, I'm in Toowoomba and we do in furniture what Rolls-Royce does in cars, and I'd really like to talk to whoever's in charge up there and about this thing. And she said, okay, I'll get someone to get back to you. No one would ever ring me back.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I got a lucky break, because one Friday when I rang, there was a different girl on it. She was a temp. And this time I said to her, you're a different girl. And she said, yeah, I'm a temp. And I said, oh, okay, where are you from? She said, I'm from Miles, which is west of
Toowoomba.
And I said, oh, I'm from Toowoomba. And she said, oh, really? So what do you do? And I told her what I did. And she said, oh, I think you did a piece of furniture for my father. Do you remember so-and-so? And I said, yes, we had this big chat, and now we had some relativity together. And and then I said, look, I'm actually trying to – I knew the guy's name now. I'm trying to get through to Mr. Piper, but the girl who's been there all week just doesn't ever get back to me. And she said, he's in the office now. I'll put you straight through.
Ah, great.
And when I got him on the phone, he was a completely different kettle of fish, but he had a gatekeeper that wasn't going to let me near him, you see. So anyhow, he and I had a chat. I went down and see him and put the idea to him of doing the Rolls-Royce and I think we called it the Rolls-Royce Darling Downs Country Tour.
Yep.
And we put four or five cars together. We filled them up with people and drove up and did a little afternoon tea and a lunch. And, you know, it was all very, very – we had opera singers and it was fantastic.
Yeah, fantastic. And that came to your place, obviously.
Yeah, they came to the workshop and we showed them what we did. Now, interestingly, we didn't get any business out of that on the day, but one of the people who was there came back about 8 years later, and he flew up in his helicopter and landed and spent a lot of money. And
as you do.
And he said to me, you mightn't remember me, but I was at that event that you put on with Rolls-Royce. And I went, well, there you go. And he said, tell me, why did you pick Rolls-Royce? And I said, well, it goes back to in the mid-80s when I did a course with a lady on image, a lady by the name of Bobby Gee, and an American lady. And she talked about image, and she said, you know, you've got to really set your goal on what you want to become. And when I went back from that, I said, you know what? I want to become the Rolls-Royce of furniture.
Wow.
So when you set something, that's a long time ago, yeah?
Yeah, that's a long time.
When you set something as a goal and you say, I want to be the Rolls-Royce of furniture, I want to do what Rolls-Royce do, and then you see it lead to that first relationship that I had with one of the local dealers, and then when you see now here it is where we actually have a car with my signature on it and made in Toowoomba, Australia on the tread plates, that to me is pretty amazing, because what you focus on, you move towards. And there it is. That's a classic example of it, isn't it?
Oh, that's a wonderful example. And there's so many gems of wisdom that has come out through those couple of stories. And just so that we capture them for the audience and the listeners, is that, you know, what you focus on is what you move towards, which is, I think, terrific. And equally, you know, you sowed some of those seeds so long ago, but they took a few years to bear fruit. And of course, you know, we just don't know what's going to happen. So I'm of the view, and it seems like you are too, that we're constantly sowing seeds, and, you know, some will take longer to bear fruit than others, and that's fine, but you never know. And you just don't know where these things are going to take you.
One of the great things about growing up on a farm is you learn about patience, because when you plant some apple seeds and you're going to grow an apple tree, you know that you're going to be waiting 7 years before you get a crop off the tree.
Yep.
So, you know, you've got to think of other things to do in the meantime, and you've got to have a long-term plan. And long-term plans, I thought I had long-term plans, but when I heard about, was it Soshiro Honda? And years ago I heard that he had put together a 100-year plan for his business for Honda.
Goodness.
And I thought, oh, my goodness, the guy's going to be dead. Like, why would he do something like that? How silly is that? Until I realized that he was talking about building a generational business.
Yes.
And, you know, that may not apply to everybody who's listening, but if you've got that long-term vision for yourself and your family, then maybe you're looking at how can we create intergenerational wealth for our families that is preserved and grown and looked after. And, well, what do we need to make sure comes into play to have that happen? How do we need to educate our children so that they grow up not thinking that, you know, there's lots of money around and I can just spend it and do whatever I want with it, but that money is a tool and it needs to be looked after and conserved and worked with very carefully, and what do I need to learn to do to be part of this intergenerational vision for our family's future?
Yeah, look, that's wonderful advice. And again, one of the things that I love what you've spoken about there, David, is taking that long-term view with your business. And yeah, it's a funny thing because we live in a fast-paced world. We live in a, you know, place where we're instant messaging, we're Facebooking, we're SMSing. Yeah, we're doing all sorts of things instantly. And there seems to be an appetite for instant gratification to a degree. And, you know, I certainly see some of that translating into the business space as well. You know, why haven't I made my first million? It's week two, you know. And so what I really love that you've described so eloquently is the patience and the fact that you've taken, you know, a long-term view to your business, and that has, you know, rewarded you very handsomely with some of the things you've been able to do and experience as a consequence. So, mate, kudos to you. I'm really keen to explore a little more of the journey, because clearly as you've gone from, you know, restoring furniture into making high-end mechanical furniture with secret compartments, obviously that's not a transition that you make overnight. And I'm sure there were some challenges along the way as well. You've already mentioned one of them about the business that didn't survive. But I'm curious to know, what other challenges have you come across and how did you get around them? And I guess the real question I'm trying to ask is, yeah, what did you learn and what would you do differently if you had your time over?
Yeah, the incident that you talked about wasn't the only one of those. We've done that twice in our lives. In the year 2000, we lost everything again. This time we had a lot more to lose. And so that was a really big disaster. And 2008 knocked us around as well, as I think it did every luxury brand in the marketplace.
Yep.
You know, out of these different things, you become resilient. You realize that you're going to be okay, and you're okay whether you've got lots or whether you've got nothing. So I've experienced, you know, a little taste of what it's like to be able to travel the world and do some nice things. And I've also experienced quite a few times wondering how we're going to pay the wages next week and not being able to draw any wages at all. In fact, we've done that for some years at a time where we've not drawn wages out of the business or salary. Mm. Everything has just gone into keeping it afloat.
Yep.
So I've seen both sides of that thing. And what that's given me is a real strong sense that it's going to be okay, even when the worst, awfulest things that you could think can happen to you, you know that you're going to be okay. And, you know, I've got a very strong faith, and so I stand on that. And I'm experienced enough now to understand that things aren't critical, that it's going to be okay, and that everything's negotiable. It's amazing how many times I've heard people say, well, that's it. That's it. That's all it's ever going to be, and that's it.
Yeah.
And it's not it at all.
Yeah.
In fact, it's nowhere even near it. Whatever it was.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can take a lot of heart in looking from somebody who's been 40 years down the track with these things to know that if you've been going for 5 years or 10 years and all of a sudden you've hit an incredibly rough patch, and that rough patch might be in business, but it also might be a personal rough patch.
Yep.
I come out of a very difficult childhood in one particular area, an abuse area.
Yep.
And that really played with my head. In fact, it caused me some really significant mental health problems for many years. And there were a couple of times when I was suicidal.
Oh, wow.
And you get to a point where there's just no hope.
Yeah.
And you don't know what to do and you just give up. And I now understand that there's always hope, that there's that nothing is ever as bad as what it looks. And when I don't have to look around very far to discover people who have had maybe an accident and lost both arms and both legs, and I'm thinking, what are you going on about? Seriously. Yeah. Like, and then you see them out there doing all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, I can't. I've never jumped out of an airplane. I'm not going to go. And you see somebody doing that. You know, I just saw one the other day, a gentleman with no arms, no legs, and he's skydiving. I'm thinking, get out of town.
Yeah, wonderful.
You know, so there's a lot to be said for stepping back and just staying calm and just relaxing and going, it's going to, you know what, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And even when you think it's not, it will be.
Yeah.
It'll be okay.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
So obviously resilience is something that, you know, you've nurtured over the years and, you know, either through circumstance or whether you've had that innately, I suspect a bit of both. And obviously you've got a wonderful relationship with Margaret, of course, and, you know, she's obviously your rock, I guess, in a way. What I'm also, you know, wanting to know from you, David, is, you know, you've built this, you know, brand, you've built this exquisite business that does amazing things. And for those listening, you know, a couple of key things that you think you might have done really well over the years, you know, what do you think has, you know, contributed to your success?
Okay, well, I for a long time, I chased absolute perfection. So going back a long time ago, I started saying, okay, I want to be the best in the world at what we do.
Yep.
And I pursued that. Now, trying to go for perfection, I've discovered, is a very expensive and difficult thing to do.
Yes.
Because what happens is that if it costs $1,000 to get something to a point where it's at 60%,
yes,
it will double in cost to go to 70%.
Yes.
It will nearly double in cost again to go to 80%. And to get it to 90%, it'll be around three or four times the cost again. Now, if you just work that all out, it's an extraordinary increase.
Yes.
And when you look at our pieces and you look at a bar cabinet for $180,000 or a table for $80,000 or $200,000 or $500,000, because we've done all those things, you think, but it's just a table. It's just a cabinet. What's going on here?
Yeah.
But you can buy a table where somebody has invested perhaps 10 hours in it, or you can buy a table that somebody has invested their entire lifetime in learning how to do it and then spends 2 years building it.
Fantastic.
And they're two completely different animals, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely, massively.
So as I chased down that road of perfection, I really have continued to focus on always doing the absolute best with the best that is available. So we've always gone for the best materials that you can possibly get. And often that has meant, when it comes to hardware, there wasn't the best available. Mm. Like, what was available and the best there was out there wasn't good enough. Yeah. And it was sloppy, it was this, it was that, didn't have great design, it was not resolved well. And so we started a long time ago making our own hardware.
Goodness.
And making our own hinges and our own catches and levers and the systems that make these things work.
Mm.
And then we started looking for the best finishes, and we employed French polishers who were trained polishers, and they would be able to get it to a certain point, and we'd go, no, but that's not what we want. We want to bet it. It's not good enough. Look at that. You can see that. See that mark in it. You can see that dent in there in the grain. You can. It's not. I want a really full, beautiful finish. So we started experimenting ourselves, and we've learnt how to do things with a finish. And if anybody has a look at our Instagram site, you'll see the feedback that I get from craftsmen around the world, and these are some of the best craftsmen around the world, and they're constantly asking us, how on earth do you get that finish?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, you know, it's just what we do, but I'm coming to understand that it's not just something that anybody can do. It's something that we've generated skill sets in over years and years of experimentation and of never being satisfied, always wanting to be better, always wanting to be better. And every time we make something, we look at it and go, well, that was good. But if we did it next time, we would do this and we'd do that and we'd do this. And, and the next time it comes along, we change that and we make it better.
I love that attitude and that culture of constant improvement, thinking, you know, that was good, but what can we do differently to improve it for next time? I think that's wonderful. And just again, to just recap some of those key lessons there for the audience listening, what I really love that you've just said, mate, is when you're talking about the two different tables, one, you know, could be, you know, built in 10 hours. In my case, I could probably spend 100 hours trying to build a table and it would still look a bit agricultural, but that's okay. But the alternative, of course, is someone who's dedicated their life to this particular craft and then spends 2 years of their life making that particular piece. And that's very much what happens in dentistry. We sometimes have patients come and see us and they go, you know, what do you mean you're charging me that amount of money for that particular filling? It only took you, you know, 40 minutes or 50 minutes to do that. And, you know, the glib answer I give them, and I completely acknowledge it sometimes, you know, I have to be cautious how I, you know, phrase this, is that it didn't take me 15 minutes to do it. It actually took me 21 years of practice to do it.
And of course,
that's what they're paying for. It's not the you know, the 50 minutes that it took me to do a filling. It's that experience. It's the same as you. We're in the same kind of thing. So that's terrific.
And it's only, honestly, in the last relatively very short period of time that I've started to understand how valuable what we do actually is.
Yeah.
And as I've done that, I've started to be bold and start to ask the sort of money that we should be asking for things instead yes. of accepting cost plus 10%.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And cost plus 10%, you can't make a living out of. It's ridiculous. And the other thing is that until you really appreciate and value what you do, the people you do business with won't value what you do.
Oh, absolutely. It's a constant thing that I, you know, the guys I work with in my Practice Max Mastermind, we talk a lot about building value for what we do, because in my experience, and it seems like in yours too, that your clientele will place as much value on it as you do and no more. Mm. So if you're not placing high value on what you do, then we can't expect others to as well. So that's a key lesson there, David. That's fantastic. Mm. So you've gone through this transition. Now you're into the bespoke furniture, the Art Deco mechanical furniture with the secret compartments. And as you've gone about building that particular brand, that business, you know, there's a lot of people when you serve a high end, you know, niche such as you do, that, you know, ultimately, you're not going to be able to service the whole market, and that's fine. When you decided to go ultra high end, you know, were there any moments of trepidation when you thought, oh my goodness me, I could potentially lose some of my client base here? Were there any fear points there? Was there a leap of faith you had to take?
Yes. as we moved from, going back like 30 years, and we moved from fairly simple furniture into more complicated pieces of furniture, and I would make a piece that perhaps previously I'd have made a $15,000 piece, and suddenly I was making a $50,000 piece.
Yep.
And we were doing that still out at Dalby in Western Queensland in the 80s, when that was serious money.
Yeah.
And my usual clients at that time had been spending maybe $2,000 or $5,000 having something restored, or they may have then had something built that cost $4,000 or $5,000. And now all of a sudden they find that I'm making $50,000 pieces. So they just all said, oh, David's too expensive, we can't go there.
Yeah.
But when that happened, we moved up to a different bracket of people, and suddenly we were meeting people in Sydney and in Melbourne and in Brisbane and the Gold Coast and Perth, who had a different expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for somebody that could do something exclusive and and really beautiful that fitted what they wanted and was innovative and was like nothing that they'd ever found. And they were prepared to pay an amount of money for that. And the amount of money that they were prepared to pay for that was more like $20,000, $50,000, $100,000, $150,000.
Yeah.
And then as we started to push the limits of what was possible, we started to realize that you could spend a lot more time on detail here and you could spend a lot more time on detail there and you could do this and make it do that.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you had spent some hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours on something, and Margaret would say to me, well, how are we ever going to get paid for that? Yeah. Like, that's crazy. Who's going to pay for that? And then we discovered that there's another group of people, and that group of people are looking for a $200,000 dining room table because they have presidents come and stay at their place.
Yeah.
And or they have the king or the queen of whatever country. And what sort of dining room table do you put someone like that down at? Right? Do you put them down in IKEA or do you So their expectation is that there's got to be something out there that's really amazing and special, and that's what they've got to have.
Yep.
Well, now we're starting to move into an area of super yachts.
Yes.
And we're starting to meet a new group of people whose expectation is at a completely level way above that again.
Wow.
Like way above that again. And when that happens, as you do that each time, the group that you were with, they become raving fans but not so much clients, and but a few of them still come back and get things and you still do things for them.
Yep.
But you meet a whole new group of people.
Yeah.
And you move into that level. And it's a matter of just totally faith, I guess, believing, trust, that this is the case. And what you need to do is do some investigating. So I did some investigating and I discovered that, well, I met a guy actually in Perth who makes the world's best tenders for super yachts. So a tender for a super yacht is like the boat that is stored on board. And it comes out of a garage on the side of the yacht, and it's lowered down, and they take it to shore. So it's the representative of the boat.
Yes.
When the boat's moored out there, and you can't really see the boat, so what comes to shore is what people see, and it's got the it's the representative, and it's got to stand up and say, this is what our boat's all about.
Yes.
And so this gentleman, so there are tenders for yachts that range in price from, oh, I don't know, a few thousand dollars for a small thing.
Yep.
But most tenders these days are probably more like in the $20,000 to $200,000.
Goodness, okay.
No? But this guy makes tenders that are $9 and $10 million each.
Wowzers. Okay.
He has a 2.5 or 3 year waiting list.
Yeah. This is about being oversubscribed, right?
Right. He's oversubscribed, isn't he?
He is massively oversubscribed.
And so I went over there to Perth a couple of weeks ago. I had to speak at an event for Private Wealth Network and Rolls-Royce on some things over there on design and sort of tell the story about the things that we do. And I had the opportunity to meet him.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, it was a really interesting experience just to realize that there's a market for $5 and $10 million runabouts.
That's phenomenal.
So, you know, the tenders for yachts. And I came back from that thinking, okay, just get on with this. Go on. Reset your goals, get yourself out there. It's okay. Market yourself out to the right people and the word will get out. And even though you're now moving to a point where a lot of your current clients are going to go, well, that's it, we can't afford David, there's a whole other group of people who will.
Absolutely.
And at the end of the day, some of your old clients are going to still stick with you and they'll afford what they can afford.
Yep.
And but you'll be able to give them a much better result if you're making a decent profit.
That is absolutely – sorry to interrupt you. I don't mean to cut across you there, mate, but that is an absolutely, you know, wonderful piece of wisdom for anyone listening there, that, you know, if you're making a decent profit, you can actually give your existing clientele a fabulous experience. But if you're kind of doing, as David said earlier, the cost plus 10% version of dentistry, it's going to be very difficult to, you know, where the margins are so small, to make a quid, so that, you know, the experience that you can offer is always going to be potentially a little less than you would otherwise like to give. You know, would you agree with that, mate?
I would, but there's a critical point.
Yep.
You've got to be able to give the value for money.
Oh, completely.
Okay. And if you aren't at the point yet where you can give the value for that higher money, then you need to educate yourself and get there.
Yeah.
And so I've spent an enormous amount of money educating myself because I never did a trade. So I've got so many books you wouldn't believe. I read like crazy.
Yep.
I read something the other day that some of the most successful leaders are the biggest readers you'll ever meet.
Yes.
And I've always found that that's the case. And so I read all sorts of things. And, you know, Margaret loves it when I play trivia with the kids because I come up with all these answers because I read so much.
Yeah.
But you've got to be across all sorts of things. You've got to be aware of what's going on, and you've got to be researching and growing yourself and becoming the person who can give that level of service. And part of that level of service includes being a personality.
Yes.
You got to be able to talk to people and make them feel comfortable and make them enjoy their experience. And I have met quite a few professionals who are not very personable.
I'm sure you've met plenty. I have too. And it's an interesting comment as well, David, because, you know, what I'm hearing you say is it's one thing to say that, you know, I'm going to charge, you know, $5 or $10 million for a tender, right? Because that represents the particular boat. But if you're the guy charging that kind of money, you've got to deliver on that, and where it's still great value for that $5 or $10 million. If you're going to be the most expensive, you've got to be the best, right?
Yes. Yeah. And like, I'll give you a classic example just on our own. So a year or two ago, we were asked to quote on a particular job.
Yep.
And it was a pair of cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that two other companies had quoted on these same cabinets, and their quotes were $15,000 and $20,000, and my quote was $85,000.
Yep.
And the company who was handling the tender, so we normally deal directly with our clients, but yes. In this instance there was a project being done and there had been a company brought in to manage that, and so they were dealing with that, and they were completely incredulous. They thought that I was completely off the wall crazy, and they called me in to please explain what on earth I thought I was doing.
Yep.
This was so ridiculous that they had to meet me. So I sat down and I said, well, it's like this. You've specified these different things, and I noticed from the drawings that what you're asking us to make won't perform to those specifications. For instance, you want these shelves to carry a certain load, but you've got leather lining on the inside of the shelves. And so we've come up with a way to have a concealed load-bearing system that's hidden and you can't see it, but each one of these brackets will carry 2,000 kilos, which is far in excess of what you need to be able to handle. But because of these various factors, it needs to be like this. But the way we've come up with it, it's seamless, and you've got a completely flush leather interior. Mm. And then I said, and this door that you've designed here, well, the glass in the door weighs 900 kilos, and so when you open the door, the cabinet's going to fall over.
Yeah.
And I just went through a list of about 30 different things, and they were just sitting there going, oh. So they said, oh, we'll get back to you. And what they did was that they wrote back to the other two people, and they said, so have you addressed this, all these points? And both of the people came back and said, no, we haven't, and we couldn't possibly do that for this sort of money, so forget it, we're not interested.
Oh, wow, so you got the job.
I got the job.
Nice. Well done.
Huh? Now, I couldn't have done that without having got to a certain point.
Yes.
Because, you know, someone will ask me, one of my clients rang me up that I had his decorator in with him in a meeting, and he said, oh, look, we're interested in having some doors made for this house that we're doing, and the doors are going to be 2.5 meters wide, and they're going to be 4 meters high.
Holy mackerel!
And I said, "Yep, okay." And he said, "Well, how do we have to handle that?" And so I went through and explained to him how you need to have ventilation coming through the door, and it needs to have foam cores, and it's this, that, and the other, and all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And he just sat there, and he went, at the end of it all, I could hear him say to the decorator, "See, that's why David's gotten the job."
Yeah. Nice.
Now, but if I hadn't had all these years of experience where we've done all these different things, we've had things go wrong, we've had to fix them, I wouldn't have known that. So I could not have done what we do today when I was 25.
Yeah, but also just to kind of add into that, mate, you had a relentless passion for excellence, and you've pursued that excellence, and you invested in yourself, developed your own skills, and, you know, again, you're now starting to reap, not starting to, you have reaped the rewards of, you know, all that hard work and effort you put in previously. And you've taken, you know, you planted that apple seed, and now your apple tree is bearing fruit, which is great.
Mm. Yep.
So that's really that long-term view we, you know, kind of spoke about, you know, half an hour ago, which is just terrific. That's great.
Yes.
Mate, I love that. Hey, what I'd really love to know from you, before we're going to let you get on with your day, because I know you've got a million things you're going to be making and creating, but I do have a couple of quick things I wanted to run past you as well. How is it that you stay ahead of the crowd? Because I'm sure there are imitators. I'm sure that there are people wanting to do the "I'm just like David Boucher, but cheaper" kind of stuff. How do you, at Boucher & Co., kind of deal with the imitators? Because one of the things that dentists often come across is understanding that their dentistry is both valuable and unique. We sometimes have people try and copy. And I'm curious to know how you've dealt with that in the past.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, yes, we have had people copy us, and we've had people steal our design. So, in other words, we've done a whole lot of design work, and the client has said, "Thank you very much," and then we've never heard from them again. And then you hear a year or so later that somebody else made that design. So we've had all those things happen.
Mm.
We control that very carefully these days so that it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I've just had an experience with a company in China that tried very hard to get us to design something for them and steal that from us, but we were able to manage it in such a way that they weren't able to achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
And that just comes with experience. But
yes.
As far as innovation goes, what I've discovered is that there is nobody else out there in the world who thinks like I do.
Yeah.
No one else has got my experience. No one else has my take on things. And I've come to understand that that's incredibly valuable, and everybody has that.
Yes, indeed.
Everybody has that.
Yeah.
So when you get to understand that your way of handling things, your way of talking to the client, your way of setting things up, the experience that you create, that's your own thing. You need to find out what that is. You need to get really good with it, and you need to own it completely, promote it well, and make it part of the fabric of doing business with you, that people get that experience. And no one can recreate that.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, if you've just tuned in here, that is a piece of marketing gold from David Boucher. That is terrific. And in essence, people might try and copy, but they cannot copy who you are and how you do things. That is just the most exquisite piece of marketing advice, David. So for everyone listening, please listen up to that and take heed. It's really, that's 24 karat gold right there. So thanks, mate. That's tops. I wanted just to finish up with a couple of other questions, because one of the things that, you know, when you're operating such a high-end business like you do, obviously you surround yourself with a team. How do you maintain the standards across your team? What is it that you guys have in-house that ensures that each piece of furniture that leaves the showroom, you know, with your signature on it, is up to your standard, even though you may not have physically been the guy on the tools for every moment of it?
Mm. It's an interesting thing because I have less and less to do with the physical workshop these days.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons for that is that I have found the best people to do the job. I've made sure that they are capable and well-resourced. I've given them a clear understanding and examples of where we need to go, and I've given them the time to work and get up their skill set to the point where they're able to produce at that level. And then I'll leave them alone.
Yeah.
I get out of the road, I set them up, and I let them go. I look after them and make sure that they're fed, watered, and got everything that they need.
Yep.
And I get out of the road. And that can entail leaving them alone for 4 or 5 weeks at a time, not even coming near the place.
Yeah, wonderful.
And they have complete ownership of it. They really feel like it's theirs, that they're part of the whole thing, that it's their dream that they're sharing in, that they're part of the story, and that they're creating history.
Oh, that's wonderful advice. Again, how to run a team is just, you know, one of those things that I think over time we learn a few things and all the rest of it, but that is an absolute shortcut. For anyone listening to the podcast today, you know, hire the best people, resource them well, let them do what they do best, and then, you know, just have a few check-ins along the way, which is terrific. I love that. Dave, what are you working on at the moment?
We've just finished a pair of very beautiful shagreen bedside tables, which is shagreen is a stingray skin material that we work with. We're specialists in that.
Yep.
And
that was in the Rolls Royce, right? That was in the interior of the Rolls Royce.
If you go on the website or you go on the Instagram account, you'll see lots and lots of that.
Yes.
We're just about to start work on a whole lot of pieces for a super yacht that's being made in Holland at the moment.
Yep.
Which will be very exciting. And then we've just had some meetings with clients from Switzerland who are building a massive, beautiful home up in the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking for some very exquisite and unique pieces. And I'm chasing the materials for that at the moment. I'm looking for particular slabs of timber, and I think I'm going to get them in Canada or in North America. And we'll ship them over here and then work with them and then ship them back to Switzerland. So, there'll be some very interesting pieces out of that. An amazing display cabinet that has secret compartments in it and some beautiful detailing, which is going to be just exquisite.
David, I've seen a lot of your stuff online and it is all exquisite, so I'm sure this will be ultra exquisite. Last question, I'd love to finish up with this, David, and it's a question that I'm fond of asking all my guests in one form or another. If you are having some people over for dinner, you had a dinner party, you know, 6 or 12 people, the number doesn't really, you know, concern me too much, but who would you like to have around the dinner table to break bread with? Who are the people that inspire you that you think you could learn from and you'd like to enjoy a meal with?
Do they have to be still alive?
No. You can go with whoever you like. Well, I mean, it might make the dinner conversation a bit dull if they're not, but yeah, we'll assume for the sake of the exercise that we can reincarnate them for the purposes of dinner.
If Jacques Emile Ruhlmann was still alive, I'd definitely have him here.
Yep.
He's the father of Art Deco and my personal hero.
Yep.
And he'd be a great one to have. There's a few of our clients who are just completely fascinating people, and I always love having them around, but I can't tell you their names because we have a very strict policy on all that sort of thing,
so I
can't tell you.
That's cool.
And I'd like to make sure my wife was there because she's just fantastic to have around for dinner.
Yeah.
In fact, I get that most nights these days, but she's really cool to have around.
Who is it that you haven't met that you would like to meet?
Goodness, I've met a lot of people, mate.
Okay.
I've met some really incredible people. So it's getting the list is getting thinner.
Oh, okay. Well, look, it sounds like it's going to be a cozy dinner for two with you and Margaret, mate. On that note, and with a couple of select nameless clients, you know, who you would have to, you'd have to kill me if you told me sort of stuff. So,
I'm sorry about that. But
we can't talk
about these things.
I completely understand and respect that. As you know, healthcare providers, privacy is something that we're big on too. So I completely get that. That's no problem at all. Hey, David, I wanted to say thanks so much for spending the time with us this afternoon. You've shared with us a lot about your story. You've given us the most intimate details of your business and your life, and I'm really, really grateful to you for that.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/podcast. And to discover how you can go large with your practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.